coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A UD professor is trying to make her work more accessible to the public, especially kids, through an exhibit at the Delaware Museum of Natural History.
If you can take and bring something that's familiar to folks, then to use it to present more complex concepts, you give them a lot of confidence and you give them tools to be successful in any venue. You know, whether they choose to become a scientist or an engineer or not.
We chat with Dr. April Clarkson about her work and the museum exhibit she created to help explain it. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also delve into the issue of Delaware's high eviction rate and meet a local inventor who wants to make getting your gear to the beach easier. Plus, we learn about a different approach to getting Wilmington kids to read more. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Being evicted can mean homelessness, as well as losing access to food assistance and employment. And legal aid groups say the court process makes it too easy for landlords to evict tenants they consider undesirable. But as Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller reports, a new state pilot program is providing more people facing eviction with lawyers.
Iris O'Neill lives in downtown Wilmington, just blocks away from high-rise offices and luxury apartment buildings. The 62-year-old finally has a place to live again after experiencing homelessness following an eviction last year. She says she was evicted from a rental in Wilmington because she reported the landlord to the county business inspectors for not maintaining the property.
Downstairs in that house, in the basement, was a whole bunch of garbage. And we kept having mice, and we were having bugs we'd never seen before. And I'm from West Virginia, so if I ain't seen it, it's something strange.
Delaware and its three counties all have eviction rates higher than the national average. Eviction Lab found Delaware's 2016 eviction rate was 5.1%, while the national rate that year was around 3%. Eviction Lab is a team of researchers, students, and website architects at Princeton University put together by sociologist Matthew Desmond, the author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. The lab created the first ever nationwide eviction data sets on evictions for the years 2000 to 2016. Eviction Lab's Adam Porton says the data is more reliable in some states than others.
All the evictions are real, but there's not perfect coverage everywhere. As it happens in Delaware, we did have really good coverage.
Kent County had the highest 2016 eviction rate, about 6%. Newcastle County's rate was about 5%, and Sussex County was 4.25%. Porton says they show higher rates of evictions than the state's Justice of the Peace courts, because there's a difference in how the two define an eviction. Eviction Lab counts an eviction when the JP judge rules a tenant can be evicted, but the JP court only counts an eviction if the constable or sheriff has to go out, physically remove someone, and change the locks.
That group is a smaller group because not every legally sanctioned eviction ends with a sheriff showing up at the door. Sometimes they just leave on their own after the court order, and in some cases, they may even work it out with their landlord. But that legally sanctioned eviction remains on their record.
Dan Akins with the Community Legal Aid Society says a number of factors can contribute to people getting evicted. For one, Delaware doesn't have enough low-income public and subsidized housing. Atkins says there's also a lack of affordable housing, where a tenant only needs to spend about a third of their income on rent.
If you look at 100 households of very low income families, okay, there are 55 affordable rental units available for every one of those 100 households that are very low income.
Atkins says there's also a large percentage of housing units that are in poor condition, particularly in Wilmington. Because of the affordable housing shortage across the state, landlords aren't motivated to spend the money to make the repairs.
Conditions are horrible, and you as a tenant are complaining about the conditions. The landlord's going to say, you don't like the conditions? Go. I have someone else waiting to take that apartment. And so there's no incentive on landlords to increase the habitability of their unit.
Iris, her daughter, and grandchildren are out of the shelter and living in a rental house because after a five-year wait, Iris got a Section 8 voucher. She says since moving back to Wilmington from Texas in 2014, she struggled to maintain housing, living in shelters before and after the eviction. While Delaware law prohibits a landlord from retaliating against a tenant exercising a legal right or making a complaint to a government agency, Iris alleges that's what happened. But she also admits withholding rent because the landlord failed to make the requested repairs.
My thing is, there's a lot of slumlords who don't want to fix stuff, you know, but they want their rent. You know, and if you stop paying the rent, then they got the right to evict you, but we have no rights to make them take care of what they got to take care of.
Iris says she became homeless because judgments on her record prevented her from securing another rental. Iris says she has four evictions dating back 12 years. But she declined to talk about those, saying past substance abuse and mental health problems played a role. She says she owes about $3,000 in judgments, which she can't afford to pay. Porden from Eviction Lab says features from a state's court system often shape the rate of eviction. He says they've seen this nationally. Classy attorneys Dan Akins and Megan Karasik say many Delaware tenants don't understand their legal rights and obligations under state law. But they also take aim at the state's court process, which they say can be unfair to tenants facing eviction. Many tenants facing eviction don't have lawyers. Karasik says because the court process in Delaware moves so fast, someone may be evicted in just 6 weeks' time.
They have an appeal right, but it's in the same court, and you can still lose the housing while you're waiting for the appeal.
Before landlords can move to evict someone, they have to send a letter demanding a tenant pay their rent and give them 5 days to pay it. Then they can file with the Justice of the Peace Court to remove the person from the unit. Atkins says Delaware has a low cost of entry for filing eviction cases. Landlords aren't required in Delaware to be represented by an attorney. And the fee to file is low, just $45 per case. Karasik also notes that if the tenant pays the rent after the five-day grace period, the landlord can still ask the court to evict them. Karasik says Delaware has no minimum rental threshold for a person to get evicted. A person owing $5 or $500 has the same chance of being evicted under Delaware law.
The pushback to that argument is that, you know, nobody or no rational actor would pay the $45 filing fee if they weren't owed at least $45, but actually they do, and we've seen it.
Classy attorneys also complain that JP judges aren't required to graduate law school to handle these cases. And the appeals go back to the JP court, not to a higher court. A three-judge panel hears the appeals. An administrative law task force set up in the fall of 2017 is working on draft legislation that includes changes to Delaware's landlord-tenant code. Its ranks include some of the top lawyers in the state. A task force member says some changes being considered are ones Classy attorneys favor. But lawyers and lobbyists for landlords and property managers are pushing back, and those changes could be dropped or spun off into separate legislation. The earliest a bill would be introduced is January. Landlords say the court process takes too long. Tenants leave units a mess, which can take a lot of money to fix, and no one is really evicted for small amounts of rent owed. But despite multiple attempts over a three-week period, representatives from industry groups, attorneys, or lobbyists failed to respond to requests for comment or declined to speak on the record. Eviction Lab's Adam Porden says evictions have consequences on a family's financial, physical, and mental well-being.
You're more likely to face job loss, face possible temporary or long-term homelessness. Your kids may have to move schools. Their performance in school may suffer over time. And overall, there's some research that eviction is detrimental to long-term health.
Iris says after she and her family were evicted, they struggled to track down her daughter's medication, which she gets by mail. Her daughter has Gaucher disease, which means she's missing an enzyme that breaks down fat in cells.
Due to eviction and had the mail go to the shelter, was throwing the mail away. All of this because, you know, because of the eviction from 1217. We've been through hell. You know, we just now starting to get things back together.
In January of this year, Classy received $225,000 from the Delaware State Housing Authority and the Federal Home Loan Bank of Pittsburgh to help reduce homelessness. It was part of $1.2 million handed out to 10 groups across the state. Classy, along with the Legal Services Corporation and Delaware Volunteer Legal Services, is using the money to provide more attorneys to represent people facing eviction. Atkins says they'll be evaluating whether people who get legal representation are more likely to keep their housing. Iris had a legal aid lawyer represent her in her eviction. She says while she lost her housing, they were able to stay in the rental for longer without paying rent and left owing just 1 month's rent. She credits getting the Section 8 voucher as being the most helpful. Her family now lives in a four-bedroom house with a three-car garage. Her Social Security payments cover her rent.
The main thing is that the two-year-old can go out there and ride his bike up and down, and he don't have to go out in the street. That's what made me be here. So I just want to be comfortable.
An eviction can happen to anyone. Deborah Gilbert White has a PhD. She didn't have a substance abuse problem or a mental health issue. She didn't have small children. In 2011, she lived in Newcastle County, and because she was underemployed, fell behind on her rent. She was evicted and for a time homeless. Gilbert White now lives in D.C. and is an advocate for the homeless. Iris says if she wouldn't have gotten the Section 8 voucher, she would still be homeless. More than 30,000 people are on waiting lists in Delaware for public housing and Section 8 vouchers. Sarah Mueller, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And The Green continues in a moment with another piece from one of our University of Delaware intern contributors. This one looking at how one UD professor is making her work more accessible by connecting with kids. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you another piece from one of our University of Delaware interns this spring. DJ McCauley spent her time with us focusing on science and health reporting, and she follows up her previous piece about a virtual reality cave at the University of Delaware's Star Campus with one on how one UD professor is making her research more accessible by partnering with the Delaware Natural History Museum to connect kids to that research. The professor is Dr. April Clarkson. She and her team are currently working on ways to engineer cultures for studying disease progression, like creating mock tissues to study cancer cell growth. The exhibit she created takes some of the same principles of biomimicry that inform her work and shows young people how they can see those principles in the world around them. The exhibit is currently wrapping up its latest run at the Delaware Museum of Natural History. You can find DJ's piece right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she set up an interview with Dr. Clarkson, an associate professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering and material science and engineering at UD. I recently visited Dr. Clarkson in Newark to chat about her work and this Natural History Museum exhibit. First off, let's just talk a little bit about you and your research. Kind of in broad strokes, what are you working on?
Yeah, we're really interested in how the environment that surrounds a cell, and so those are human cells inside of the body, how that environment that they experience influences what they do, whether they enter into a state for healing a wound, for example, upon injury, or whether those are cancer cells that are lying dormant or asleep and wake up with changes that happen upon injury. And so we're trying to design then materials that allow you to look at that, to be able to see how a cell wakes up in response to a stimulus like an injury. And then design materials as well then that deliver therapies.
So how did that work wind up connecting you with the Delaware Natural History Museum to create this biomimicry exhibit?
Yeah, so we were really fortunate to receive a grant from the National Science Foundation that was several years ago that was support of career development for me and in our research, where we were trying to design these materials then to understand triggers for wound healing cells. And we really wanted a better material to do that. And so what better way to design a material than to be inspired by nature itself, so to speak, in this case, the human body. So we're designing materials then that are inspired by the tissues, the environments the cells experience inside of their bodies. And we wanted to figure out a way to get that to the public, that message of how you can design technologies inspired by natural living systems. And so we partnered with the museum then to try to bring that message, where they have a fantastic exhibits where there's a lot of different natural systems that have inspired technology.
Talk a little bit about the design of the exhibit. What are some of the things that it covers and what people who engage with the exhibit are actually kind of learning as they go?
So what people are learning about are a couple of things. So we try to present them with something they may be familiar with, right? So something that many people are familiar with, for example, is Velcro. So Velcro that, you know, these fasteners, if you will, that we use to hold our shoes on for children in particular, amongst other things, was inspired by a natural system, by burrs, these seed pods that plants use to distribute their seeds. So they get caught on fur and they get distributed. So this is something that is present in the museum, right? These different types of natural systems. That's a really nice segue then to present how the nature inspires technology. So we went through the museum and looked at different creatures that they had that had inspired technology. So they have a focus in particular on mollusk, so squids, for example. And so that's inspired different types of jet engines or propulsion systems. They have also then a focus on birds and bird eggs. And so the kingfisher, for example, this part of their exhibit, the bill on the kingfisher has inspired the shape of the bullet train, which facilitates them going really rapidly. So we try to then highlight those aspects in terms of how technology has been inspired by nature, and then lead into more of what we do, which is then now drilling down from the high-level technologies that are human size to thinking about things that are on smaller scales, you know, smaller than the width of a human hair, which is where we operate.
I imagine that the goal ultimately is getting people to kind of connect those things in their mind and understand that connection between nature and what they see in their everyday life.
Exactly. I think it's key, right, that we're surrounded by an amazing world, and let's be inspired by it and also try to understand it.
One of the things I found interesting that you said in our piece was that you felt it was important to start breaking down these kind of complex concepts, even with pre-K kids who aren't even really like reading on their own at that point. Why is it important to engage people at that young of an age?
Well, I think that people underestimate, I think, actually pre-Kers. Mm-hmm. You know, the brain has completed most of its growth in terms of size and development, 90% of that by the age of 4. Mm-hmm. And so pre-Kers actually have a lot of intellectual capacity. They just don't have a lot of formal training, mm-hmm. but they're naturally curious. And so why not harness that curiosity and start presenting to them with familiar concepts, really the principles of discovery, not just in a eureka way, per se, but also in a very methodical, scientific way. But, you know, learning how to observe something in nature and then to ask questions about it. And how do you think about designing an experiment, say, to try to understand systems better? And I think they're quite capable of it. I'm here at the University of Delaware, for example, the Early Learning Center. I have two young boys that are there. Mm-hmm. The teachers there do an amazing job showing them how to design an experiment, but again, with familiar objects. You know, the 5-year-old's teacher, Ms. Blouse, did like a tea brewing experiment. Mm-hmm. And then I told her I actually do a much more sophisticated version of that with my college students. And so it was funny that we had the same inspiration. But if you can take and bring something that's familiar to folks, then to use it to present more complex concepts, you give them a lot of confidence and you give them tools to be successful in any venue. You know, whether they choose to become a scientist or an engineer or not, those skills will serve them well in life. Discovery and curiosity and problem-solving tools.
How important is it for people like yourself and your team doing this kind of research to also carve out this kind of time to do this kind of work in science education and outreach, to have you who are actually kind of doing that day-to-day work and research to then connect with the public in this way?
Well, I think it's really important to bring the science that we're doing and the different discoveries that we're making, the different technologies that we're developing, to the public so that they can appreciate the contribution that science and scientists and engineers make. I think also so that they can learn themselves, right? So I think a lot of people are really interested in science and technology, but there might be a perceived barrier to accessing it. And so that we as scientists have an obligation to communicate effectively with the public about the different types of things we're doing and give them the opportunity to learn about it. So it's something that I think is quite important. We try to then train our students in those processes, so not just lab skills or quantitative calculations, but also how to effectively communicate. And so that's something that through different fellowship programs that we have here on campus that we really emphasize. For example, we have a chemistry-biology interface program funded by the National Institutes of Health that we try to bring then communication skills as part of the training for those students, and something I try to do for students in my own lab. And so we're trying to bring the immediate knowledge, but also train students on how to effectively communicate. And participating in these types of activities with the museum helps to train the students on communication.
Is that kind of about the concept of setting an example for these future scientists, that it kind of builds on itself?
Absolutely. I think you want to show them that this is valuable and that it's important to set aside a portion of our time to do these types of activities. So certainly setting an example and being a good role model, being a good mentor, is something that's really important in our jobs.
How also does it help, you think, in terms of kind of working with younger people who are looking to pursue a career, those who maybe aren't already at the college level, but they're still kind of thinking about, is this a career I want to get into? How important is this to kind of helping them kind of find their way a little bit and decide if this is something that is interesting to them?
Absolutely. I think that at least I found when I was growing up that I knew that engineers existed, and I was told that that was a good career path. But that was about the level of it. I thought that all engineers built buildings or drove trains. Despite not understanding what an engineer did, I thought, well, they problem solve, and I think I can do that. Right. But what I was really pleasantly surprised to find then when I went to North Carolina State University when I did my undergraduate degree is that I really did want to be an engineer. And there was such a diversity of the types of things that you could study as an engineer and problems that you could solve. Really, in my opinion, you can solve anything. Right. You can solve any problem with the tools that we teach. And so I want to be able to bring that to the people who are younger, right? So like, even though I didn't have access to that information, I think if people knew younger that they will have lots of different opportunities they couldn't even imagine if they pursue, education in science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, that they could have lots of opportunities in their future that they shouldn't feel limited, so to speak, and really should hopefully be inspired to dig in school, to be able then to come one day to solve these really big problems.
Is that especially important for women, minorities, underrepresented communities to have that kind of contact and being inspired in that way? Since maybe in a lot of ways those particular subsets don't maybe get, they get even less than the typical student in terms of a push in that direction.
Sure. I think it's really important that all people see that they can be successful in this career. Mm-hmm. And so certainly people who are underrepresented in engineering, which include women and minorities, we want to communicate to them, along with all people, that you're welcome here, right? And you can be successful here.
And is that also true, I guess, in terms of just engaging with the public? Is targeting those groups that maybe don't normally get maybe as much of an opportunity to engage in science or engineering, particularly students who maybe don't get very much of it outside of what they experience in their classroom and in a limited classroom time period?
Absolutely. I mean, there's, the public education system is amazing in terms of all of the things that they work to help students with and communicate to them. But certainly there are things that aren't going to fit into that, right? And so, yeah, if we can engage people through existing institutions that they're familiar with, that you know, while we want to bring people to campus, it's not always realistic to bring people to campus. So by partnering with folks like the museum and other entities like that, then we can really reach audiences that we normally couldn't reach. And, you know, one way is by partnering with schools. One way is partnering with museums and other types of organizations. But it's really a concerted effort to reach a broad audience. Yeah, and to communicate to people that you can do this.
Do you have any other kind of future outreach possibilities that are on your radar right now?
Oh, good question. certainly, outreach is something that I'm passionate about, and education of people. My students started a podcast that they interview their fellow students about their work, about their science and engineering activities, towards bringing it to the public. That's on 91.3 FM, as well as that can be downloaded through Apple Podcasts. And so I think we've been thinking about ways that we might be able to expand that and try to bring it to new audiences and maybe increase the diversity of topics. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing that's on my radar. The other is thinking about the updating of this kiosk that mm-hmm. we developed with the museum. And deploying it in new ways. So in the fall, I'm going to be working with our chemistry biology interface program to then expand the content past my work, mm-hmm. right? And to start to integrate some of the work of other researchers on campus. And then what we're aiming then to do then is deploy it in new ways. One of the suggestions from the museum is, you know, partnering with some of the hospitals, for example, and then being able to deploy that potentially in their lobbies to reach people. And there's some exciting work and a variety of topics going on, but within our chemistry biology interface program, my colleague, Professor Catherine Grimes, so she works on understanding the immune system mm-hmm. and how it responds to bacteria, which can be beneficial or it can be detrimental in the context of immune diseases. And so, you know, trying to start to bring some of those concepts to the public as well through this kiosk mechanism. So launching into a number of directions with that, what I think was overall a successful concept and launching that we had with the museum, so making that bigger.
Thanks to UD Associate Professor of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering and Material Science and Engineering, Dr. April Clarkson, for her time on The Green this week. And remember, you can check out our intern contributor, DJ McCauley's story on Dr. Clarkson's work and the biomimicry exhibit at the Delaware Museum of Natural History right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. In our next segment, we introduce you to a local woman who hopes her invention will revolutionize the way you tote things to and from the beach. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Going to the beach is supposed to be fun, but sometimes hauling toys, chairs, towels, coolers, and more across the hot sand to and from your favorite spot can give you an unwanted headache. Sussex County inventor Jennifer Schultz believes she's come up with a solution to that problem, designing what she calls a unique piece of luggage for the sand. It's called the Sand Slider Beach Caddy. It has a roller on one side for pulling it on the pavement, and when you reach the sand, you can flip it over to its rounded, smooth side so it'll glide easily across the sand. Schultz recently spoke with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about her creation.
All right, I want to set the scene because, you know, we've all been there. You know, we get ready to go to the beach in the summer, and whether we're married, partnered, fiancé, husband, wife, we may have children, and we think it's a great idea, and we start packing things up for the beach. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a lot of things to take to the beach, and we get there, and we decide, once we try to carry, you know, the kids' wagons and mm-hmm. the tools and the beach towels and the umbrellas and the coolers and the beach chairs, it really wasn't a good idea. So local inventor and Sussex Countyan Jennifer Schultz is joining us today because she has come up with a better way to go to the beach. It's called the Sand Slider Beach Caddy. Jennifer, thank you for joining me.
Oh, I am so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Kelly.
Look, I set the scene. We've all been there. We've all done that. It's, you know, it's a great idea to go to the beach and enjoy yourself. But once we get there and we open up the back of the car and we see how much stuff we have to get to the beach, then we decide maybe it wasn't a good idea. So tell me how your invention, the Sand Slider Beach Caddy, came about.
Well, you hit it right on the nail. And when you go to my website, thesandsliderbeachcaddy.com, when you page through it, you'll find a video that highlights that exact struggle that you just described. Because most of us, there's two things that are on our mind when we decide to go to the beach, especially in season. And it's, do I want to deal with the traffic? And getting your gear from the car to that spot you have your eye on way over there that looks like it's a little bit freed up and there's a little bit of room. And you see it over there and you want to get there. And I myself find it very difficult to get my supplies over there, especially when I have a group of people with me and all of us are carrying our stuff. And I noticed other people having the same kind of struggle. And what I did was, initially, I came up with my own little, okay, now what can I do to make this easier on myself and my friends and people who come visit me? And I even started with a big vinyl laundry bag was the thing I came up with. And they actually worked pretty well. But, of course, you know, they can't handle all the, you know, all the rocks and the twigs and the shells.
Well, I would think the wheels aren't big enough on a bag like that, on a laundry bag like that.
Well, and as a matter of fact, since you mentioned the wheels, the only other product available that is supposed to help you do get your stuff to the beach have wheels. And I will tell you, I bought one of those products, and our sand is too thick. It'll only work on hard or very thin sand. So if you're climbing over any dune, you know, in a fishing beach, or even just walking onto Rehoboth Beach and trying to get to that little spot over there, you're spending more effort tugging that wheeled wagon than you are trying to carry everything all over your body, hanging one thing here, hanging another thing there, and da da da, and it just doesn't work. So I had the idea that, you know, you need something that slides, okay? And sliding, you know, and I knew sliding would work if it had the right materials, that slides over the sand. Okay, so you don't have to pull. It's like pulling your beach gear through a foot of snow, and it is very difficult. I interviewed people on the Rehoboth Boardwalk who I saw with a couple of different types of wagons. Some of them are cart-like, and some of them are wagon-like. And I said, "Well, how do you feel about this? It's the only thing out there. I need something." I mean, that's the response I got.
All right, so I know this is radio, so try to make us picture in our minds, describe what the Sand Slider Beach Caddy looks like.
Okay, it's a compartment with a rounded bottom, so the rounded bottom will slide over the sand, okay? And it comes with one large wide wheel that once you turn the slide the Sand Slider Beach Caddy over, will also roll your caddy right back to your car.
So kind of like a wheelbarrow, kind of.
Well, it's, you know, I hate the, it's a little bit more like a unique piece of luggage. I mean, I don't like to use that word, but if we're going to paint a picture, because it closes, all right? And on the outside, they're going to be adjustable arms to put a couple of chairs, a ring on the side to put a beach umbrella, and then you open the compartment, and then you can put all your stuff inside that, and then lock it up, and there you have everything together. I'm not saying it's going to hold every single possible thing you could ever want to put on the beach, but it's going to take care of a lot of your issues.
So once you get it to the beach and you have your stuff inside, you said you're able to lock it. So it sort of acts like a safe for your stuff as well.
It is. It does. So there you are. You're going from your car. You're pulling it and by its arm. You're rolling through the parking lot. Maybe if you're on a popular beach, you're rolling it up like the boardwalky like thing by the concessions. And then when you get to the beach, you turn it over, and then the rounded bottom will slide your stuff right on top. And then you go to your spot.
Okay, so you've patented your design, and you're working with a marketing company to license and manufacture the product so it can be sold locally.
Right.
How quickly is this all going to come about in time for this beach season?
Oh, well, now that's my big challenge. So I don't know if it's going to make it to this beach season, but I am really hoping it makes it to the next beach season, because one, finding this for sale by inventor has a finite group of businesses, from big box to manufacturers, and it's a process, finding that organization that will license the product, place an order, and there we go. Okay, but it's not the only way to go, and it really is. It's like being in sales. You're this is what they're doing. They're contacting and they're showing them the video and the sandsliderbeachcaddy.com. It's also on Facebook to their main sources of buying inventions, and it doesn't. It's a process. So they started doing that in January. And it may take a while, but there's been a lot of interest. Okay, we've already got, there's one local manufacturer who has expressed interest in this, and I'm very excited about that. So they've called me. I'm going to be meeting with them. There are other ways to do this. I might try like a test run where I have a certain amount of them manufactured. And then I will, get them to the Rehoboth and Lewis and neighboring beaches, hopefully maybe to some large event that's happening, make a connection to that event and, maybe able to say a few words through a microphone and things like that. Because it is it'll fly off the shelves, because it is so, the wheeled stuff barely works.
Yeah.
Okay. And this thing that slides is, to me, a no-brainer. I know it will slide off the shelf. Well, either way. Anyway.
Jennifer, what is your background? Have you invented anything else?
I have had many ideas that came to fruition from somebody else. So I'm early retired, and I said this time I'm not going to sit on my idea. I have owned my own drive-through only coffee shop. When they were really popular over on the West Coast, and where I lived in Minnesota for a while, so I did do that. So that's an example of my taking an entrepreneurial idea. I didn't invent the idea, but I took it and ran with it, and it was very successful. So that's other than that, I had a traditional climbing the corporate ladder background in sales and marketing and training and things like that. So I have the right kind of background to business, marketing, to come up and have an idea of how to make this happen. But I don't know a lot about manufacturing, and I'm learning about that and all the things that go into it. So that's a bit about my background. And I see the sandsliderbeachcaddy.com. Sooner or later, it's going to be picked up. If I don't do like a trial run, it is going to be picked up. There is interest from some of the organizations that they talk to, but they have their own lives, and you know how it is. They'll get to it when they can and when they have time. They have their own priorities. So it's going to be a process.
Yeah, it sounds to me like maybe you need to hit up some trade shows or something with, some of these things with the Sand Slider Beach Caddy.
I agree.
Let people
with you.
Look at them, see them, try them out, because what better way to sell a product than if if me, Kelly Steele, the consumer, can feel it, touch it, look at it, that sort of thing.
I agree with you, Kelly. Trade shows and, by golly, standing right there by Dolly's, you know, as part of some big event that's going on and having them right there with me, I don't doubt that I'll be able to sell them.
All right,
there.
One more time. You've mentioned it a couple of times. One more time. Where can we see and learn more about the Sand Slider Beach Caddy?
Go to thesandsliderbeachcaddy.com, which is, I would say, that's the go-to first because it has everything in there, including the video, which gives a nutshell, and you can see a great picture. It's not to scale, but it's a picture of, it's a close picture of what it's going to look like. So I would definitely go to the website and look for that video amongst all the other information there. And also I have a Facebook page. So for example, I'll be posting this interview, you know, listen to my interview here, blah, 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 on both of those places.
Thanks to Sand Slider Beach Caddy inventor Jennifer Schultz and our Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. And we close out this week's edition of the show with Enlighten Me and more on an effort to connect Wilmington kids with reading when they get their hair cut. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The school year is almost over, and one concern during the summer is keeping kids engaged with things like reading. Well, the Wilmington Public Library is trying something different to encourage young people to pick up a book. And in this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt has more about this effort to use a familiar place to get youngsters in the state's largest city to read more.
Wilmington Public Library is putting books in barbershops. The library has partnered with a national literacy program called Barbershop Books, which aims to help Black boys ages 4 through 8 identify as readers and provides early literacy training to barbers. So far, 20 Wilmington barbershops have been equipped with shelves of fun, culturally relevant paperback books.
We're trying to derail the illiteracy epidemic in our city because we have a high volume of kids who are in high school and middle school who can't read and who are not reading at their desired grade level.
That's Wilmington Public Library Director Jamar Roming. He says the idea for the partnership came from the library mapping assets in the city of Wilmington.
What we discovered was that there were 60 barbershops in our service areas. There are more barbershops than banks, than grocery stores, than any other entity in the community. So therefore, it behooved us to figure out a way to marry our agenda with what's going on in barbershops.
And Roming says putting books in barbershops helps elevate their status.
I mean, getting a haircut is a cool thing. And so if we can somehow make reading cool, if we can have that same kind of swagger and coolness and freshness with literacy, then we can definitely enrich kids' lives. Also, we want reading to be associated with a Black male presence. And so having, you know, young Black men with Black barbers and reading, that also, you know, accomplishes that objective too.
Carl Shaw of the Wilmington Public Library says the library has conducted a baseline survey of how often reading is encouraged in the participating barbershops and will follow up in a few months to gauge the program's efficacy. He also hopes kids will spread the program's impact beyond the barbershops.
Hopefully they'll go home and, you know, let's say if they have a little brother or a cousin or what have you, instead of picking up a video game, say, hey, I read this cool book at the barbershop. Let's read a book as opposed to. So hopefully over time, reading will become more of a value to the community.
That's right.
Teron Warren owns Black Visionary Designers Barber Salon on West 8th Street, one of the 20 barbershops currently participating in the program. Warren also teaches math at Kumba Academy, where he regularly sees kids struggling to read.
I'm dealing with kids on a regular basis that are not up to level as far as reading are concerned. They're on the first, second grade level, but yet they're in sixth, seventh grade, you know, so that's a major issue. And of course, the more that they read, the better they get and the better society would be, because they'd be more educated and be successful people from that.
Warren says it isn't always easy, but encouraging reading in his shop seems to be working so far.
I promote it, definitely, and the barbers promote it. Look, read a book, you know what I mean? And, you know, most of them come in with their games. They all got phones, you know? So now you got a small battle to say, you know, put down the phone, read a book. I see sometimes they just come over and just grab a book out of nowhere. You know, they'll see the colors, they'll see the pictures.
Glenn Dudley is a barber at BVD.
When they're waiting to get their hair cut, kids go into the bookshelves and pull out a book and read it. I even gave a couple away. I said, go ahead, take them with you, you know? Like that, you know, anything positive that these kids can instill in their mind, you know, is what I'm for.
Dudley says promoting literacy is just one of the several ways BVD barbers try to be positive influences on the kids that come through their shop.
The main thing is that they get something, not just a haircut, but they leave with more as well.
Wilmington Public Library hopes to eventually expand the Barbershop Books program to all 60 barbershops in the city. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, University of Delaware intern contributor DJ McCauley, and Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them, and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.